Clubhouse.
This is Mike from Pop Culture Review, and you're listening to Love It or Leave It. There's a lot of content in the world on TV and movies. Some of it's good, some of it's excellent, some of it's just dumpster fire trash. Love It or Leave It is a review show where we basically break it down for you, tell you what it's about, and tell you whether we love it or whether we're going to leave it. Today, we're talking about Taylor Swift, Miss Americana, streaming on Netflix. Joining me today is my special guest, Will Brooks from So I'm Watching the Show. How are you doing, Will?
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. You ready to talk about Taylor Swift?
I am, actually.
Before we get into the doc, let's set the stage a little bit, because I go back with Taylor pretty much, I mean, because of how old I am, I was already a grown working adult when she really hit the scene. But tell me, what's your story with Taylor Swift? When did you get into her? If you're into her, do you hate her? Do you love her?
All of the above.
Complicated.
Yeah, all of the above. I'm in a very good place with her right now, especially after having watched this documentary. And I was going to say, on that note, you mentioned how there's just a plethora. There's nothing but content. And it's really interesting now, because something like this, I would have a hard time saying love it or leave it, because everything these days is tailor-made. It's like, this is perfect for somebody, for one person, and not for many others.
I haven't been to a Taylor Swift concert. I think people would stare at me strangely if I was to show up at a Taylor Swift concert, especially by myself. I'd be one trench coat short away of being arrested, I think.
No, she's got broad appeal.
Well, yeah, for sure, but I don't know that 42-year-old men should be going to her concerts by themselves.
Maybe, but not alone, but...
but I think there's a lot of value in this documentary. Even if you're not a fan of her work, I think just as a intimate portrait of someone who's been in the public eye since she was literally a kid, I think there's a lot here, and I think there's a lot about her message and kind of what is depicted on screen here that is completely separate from her music. So I don't think you necessarily have to be a fan of her music, you know?
Yeah, I dove right in. To go back to your actual question, my first really introduction to her was a roommate of mine. So I was probably 22 or 23.
Oh, 22.
And she was... Taylor was maybe 16. It was that first album, and it was the Our Song is the Slamming Screen Door. And sure. I made so much fun of her. She came back from her like Christmas break with that CD, and I was like, not on my watch. I was like, we are not doing this country hack shit. Like, I just, it's something about it just grated on my nerves. And then little bit, I guess it was probably the very next album, another friend of mine had it, and I was listening to it in her car, and I was kind of like, okay, this is pretty catchy. I like this. I got a few more albums in, and I just came around, you know. I could feel myself, this is getting into my late 20s, I could feel myself falling into this trap that I think many people do as they age, where they feel like they're better than pop or whatever the new thing is.
I think that's definitely true.
And I don't want to be that person who's like, back in my day, we had real music with Britney and Christina, you know.
And Backstreet was back, and it was all right. God,
that was my era. That was where my coming of age. I'm at a place now where if I hear a Shawn Mendes song or two, and suddenly I'm like, you know what? I've liked all three of these songs. I'm going to learn his name, and I'm going to like him. And One Direction, I was all in. And so someone like Taylor Swift, I was like, she's making really great pop music. I became a big fan. And then I was one of the people who got too much. She got to this place where I felt like she was acting. I felt like she was playing the victim. There was a part of me that I was kind of like, you know, you don't have to take every opportunity you see. She was giving me Queen Bee, like Mean Girl vibes, especially when she had her squad and all that stuff. And I really, weirdly, I was actually on her side with the whole Kim exposed Taylor, that thing.
Yeah,
but
sure.
I think it was wise, extremely wise of her to take a break, a real proper break. And she did. And she came back with Reputation, and just none of it worked for me. None of it. I didn't like the attitude. I thought it was petulant. I was like, nope. She kind of took
it. It's dark as fuck. I've listened to it again recently, because I've been kind of on a, since I watched this, I've been kind of on a Taylor Swift kind of re-deep dive, because it's been a while since I've listened to a lot of her music, you know, other than the obvious hits and stuff. And Reputation, I agree with you, the album doesn't largely work for me. I am impressed at how goddamn dark it is. For someone who is only, say, 10 years removed from Tim McGraw, you know, it's like, you know, she's painting her fingernails black and like making voodoo dolls kind of music. It's pretty specific.
It felt like a costume to me, though. Like, it just, it felt like, and there were elements of it that I liked, because at the end of the Look What You Made Me Do, which that is my least favorite of the entire thing. I think I've listened to the whole album once, and especially after hearing you talk about it, I'm definitely going to go ahead and listen to it again with the benefit of hindsight. At the end of the Look What You Made Me Do video, there was that scene with all the Taylors where she was kind of making fun of herself. And I did always want to give her that credit, you know, to at least be self-aware enough to present an air of self-awareness. Yeah, and so some more time passed, and I guess my biggest issue with her was I was struggling with her authenticity. I think this documentary lightly touches on that. I think to an extent she herself was going through something. You gotta try some shit out. Some things work and some things don't. Lover, I liked a lot. It's not my favorite, but it was good. It was a very good album. I think she's in a very good place right now. And I do think she's learned a lot.
Yeah, I think so, too. And I mean, I think the way this doc in particular was structured, you get to see a little bit of that journey in a way that kind of surprised me, because I think she does poke herself a little bit. I think there's maybe still an argument that there's still definitely some scabs there, that when she pulls them, she feels like a victim. But I think largely she's much more self-aware, gives a good self-diagnosis of herself, more so mm-hmm. than I think most people at an age even much older than her, which maybe speaks to what she has been through. It seems like she's pretty much aware what she has gone through. You know, I think Reputation, I'm still not crazy about the album, but after watching this and then going back and listening to it, the album makes more sense to me.
That's what I want to do. Yeah. Yeah. And there was something so sweet and almost sad about the opening of the documentary where she doesn't get any nominations, and you can see her actually get hurt, and then you can see her immediately register that it's not a big deal. She's like, I already have Grammys. Like, why is this hurting my feelings? And then she's just sort of like, I'll just make a better album next time. It was very complex feelings. And I'm actually pretty good at empathizing in general, and also empathizing with people in positions of power and or privilege. A lot of people have a tendency to be like, where do you get off? You're rich, you're famous, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, it has a whole host of other problems that come along with it.
Right,
and
right.
In particular, artists are very, they tend to be very soft souls. I think emotionally, it's a lot of work. I tend to be forgiving.
I mean, her final line of this, after she's gone through all this and she's talked about what she's been through, and, you know, the final song that's playing is, you know, is The Archer, and it's they're playing the lines about her going into combat. But her actual final words are, you know, always keep a sharp pen, but I want to have, you know, kind of a soft heart, an open heart, and thin skin. I think that speaks to your point, that to tap into the kind of music and write kind of songs that she writes. And, you know, look at her songwriting credits on her albums. There's a lot of co-writers. Her producers tend to help out and get a lot of co-writing credits, but her name is all over her albums. And it's an undeniable fact. I mean, she is writing from her experience and kind of her soul. And I give that a lot of credit, because she really does kind of put it out there. To, I think, tap into that in an artistic way, you do really have to have that mushy heart. You can't be too hard-hearted or too thick-skinned, because you won't be able to tap into the emotional depth that you need to, I think, to write compelling music.
Well, and it's where her particular brand, it's where the sweet spot is. She is sentimental. She has a lot of qualities that are regarded as traditionally feminine. And I think that's one of the reasons why she's been given as hard a time as she has by so many people, is because, you know, in my opinion, we have a sense to sort of look negatively on traditionally feminine qualities, and that she's too needy, she's too emotional, she's boy crazy, all this stuff. And it's kind of like, I think she's an immense talent, even when she's at her worst. Like, even when I'm not a fan of her, I still think she's talented.
Right.
Even if I don't particularly like what she's doing at that moment. I globbed on pretty early, and I shocked a few of my friends when I would say this, but I would say that when she was younger, she was giving me really solid Dolly Parton vibes.
Yep.
And I think people think about Dolly's aesthetic And that's not what I mean. I mean the sort of like this kind of quaint songwriting machine that you watch her do it several times in this documentary, which also covers a larger span of time than I was expecting.
There's definitely a focus of the songwriting period with Lover, but it does, the non-archival footage does go back to the Reputation songwriting days. Mm-hmm. You know, think about that. I kept thinking to myself, imagine having a goddamn camera in your face all the time. Even when you're not quote unquote on, there's someone still fucking filming you doing something. Mm-hmm. You know, when does she ever have private time? And great, yes, she has chosen this life. This is a career choice she has made. But at the same time, that has to get exhausting. Yeah, there has to come a point where you just cry on camera because you can't no longer hold it in. You just have to be yourself at some point.
I think she does get it. I think she is she's a well-oiled machine in a way that I really, really admire. Because to say again, I came of age with Brittany, Christina, Jessica Simpson, and Mandy Moore. And these days, Mandy Moore is really the only one that's going strong. I mean, Brittany, I love her. I'll defend her till the end of the world. But, you know, she's had her moments. And yeah. I think to be a celebrity, especially to be a young person, especially to be a young girl existing in this reality, it takes a real ironclad constitution and will. And because Ariana Grande is another one that it's like, I'm not necessarily a huge fan of her work, but I'm actually really, I love her a lot. I'm very proud of her for being as good at what she does as she is. And many could crumble under far less. Taylor, even with this documentary, it was absolutely vulnerable, and it was absolutely vulnerable when it needed to be. But even still, there was a slight guarded quality to it. And I think she is very meticulous about her private life. Like, even the stuff with Joel Alwyn, she talked about him for, like, mm-hmm. a minute, and we saw him twice. So it's like, she acknowledged his existence, but we really didn't. And I think we needed the glimpse. We really needed the confirmation and to see his face, but also... Well,
I think people would have called too much machinations and manipulative if she didn't show him, but she never refers to him by name mm-hmm. in the documentary. She talks about him specifically that they made a decision to have their relationship away from everything else. Mm-hmm. And I think the way he's treated in the documentary is kind of like a testament to that. I don't know if it was a thing they talked about beforehand or it was just part of whatever the arrangement was. But you're right. Yeah, you see him twice, really quick kind of glimpses. They don't really focus on him much and you never hear his name. So you just kind of have to know that's not her brother. right. Yeah, that's not her brother that she's all hugging and kissing on. That's, mm-hmm. you know, that's the guy. But I want to take a step back and I want, before we get into this, because I think there's actually a lot in here to talk about, what's your feeling about music films and music docs in general? Do you watch them? I don't know if you watch documentaries at all. Does this kind of film do it for you in a general sense, this kind of behind the curtain of celebrity?
Yes, especially if it's someone I'm interested in. This is the third that we've gotten from Netflix in as many years. The first, I would say, is Gaga's 5'2". And then last year we had Beyonce's Homecoming. And now we have this one. And I've watched all three of them. This one for me was more like 5'2". Did you watch 5'2"?
No, 5'2" was the one I have not seen. I saw Homecoming. I saw this.
Homecoming was like a feat of engineering. 5'2" is more intimate. It's even more intimate than this, I think.
Interesting.
I love music and I love the glimpses behind the scenes because something I find so fascinating about music, my history is in film and film is so often so big. It's such a massive undertaking. And it blows my mind with these music docs where it's two people in a room with a computer. And I'm like, how did this huge pop song come from that? You know what I mean? It's like, I want visually something that feels so much grander. I don't know that I would like dash to watch everything. Like I said, it would have to be someone that I'm already particularly interested in.
Right.
Because I don't know that I'm going to have the stomach for this Justin Bieber one that's coming out.
Yeah, that's going to be a hard pass for me. I think I'm a little bit like you. I think I have to be... I don't really care about Beyonce in any way, shape, or form. I appreciate her talents. I appreciate her aesthetic as a master celebrity, not unlike, you know, Jay-Z. I think the two of them are probably the most intelligent corporate pairing ever put on the earth.
Corporate's such a good word because they're like an entity, and like Taylor, they have managed to keep so much of their privacy.
Yeah, it's actually... No one knows who they really are, and I think that's totally by design, and I give them a lot of credit for that. I don't really care about her music. I mean, I was a big Destiny's Child fan back in the day, but I, you know, I watched that only because it was, like everything Queen Bee does, it was something you had to watch. It was undeniable. Cultural, it was inevitable. Yeah. Like Thanos, it was inevitable. So, you know, if I'm going to watch something, it's going to be because I'm interested in who the artist is. That's what it has to be. And like I said, I go back to Taylor Swift, you know, in her self, you know, titled album and to McGraw. And I was a 90s alt-rock kid. You know, I grew up, I came of age with like Pearl Jam and Alice in Chains and, mm-hmm. you know, that whole Seattle grunge sound. I was big in the 70s classic rock. But when the 2000s hit, I actually really turned into country music, and especially like crossover country. For whatever reason, that was where all of my music kind of went. And in 2005, 2006, when she hits with her album, I was deep into this exact genre of music, or else I would have completely missed her. You know, it was kind of a confluence of events that I found her music on the radio. You know, I subsequently bought some form of media. I've probably owned all of her albums except for Reputation and the third one, the one before Red.
Mm-hmm. Speak Now.
Speak Now, yeah. The one between Fearless and Red. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I think I've owned all of her albums in some form or fashion, and now they're on Spotify.
Speak Now was weirdly a great concert. I have the concert DVD/Blu-ray of that, because I put on concert DVDs when I'm trying to do like writing work and stuff, and I watch it all the time.
Going to live music in any form or fashion is by far my favorite activity in the world. So I'm a big sucker for live concert video footage. So
I love concerts. Kristen hates them, and we would never go, and we made a deal last year that I could have 3 a year. And so oh, I like so picked funny. Them. Yeah, I picked them. So last year we saw Florence and the Machine, Janelle Monáe, and Kacey Musgraves.
Nice. Good picks.
I love it. And also, yeah, I mean, I love the Blu-rays and the DVDs and stuff. I watch that. I love when HBO will do like the presentations and stuff. It's obviously better when you're there in person with the energy, but
yes,
because I mean, I went to 311 concert once knowing only the one song. I could have never watched that on TV, but being there with everybody, I had a blast.
Funny you mention that. I am actually a huge 311 fan, and I've been to like 7 or 8 of their concerts in my life. Their music is much better live, energy wise, and just that whole vibe than listening to it, you know, even just a CD or a guy. I probably also would not watch a DVD of a concert of theirs, but I got that. I love going to their shows, you mm-hmm. know, and, you know, being up here in New York, you know, you always have a lot of chances, you know, for large venues or small venues just to go see something. So I need to be interested in the artist before I'm going to sit down and commit an hour, hour and a half, 2 hours of my life to watching something like this, because I think the potential for manipulation and getting a packaged product is too great. I don't want to listen to an hour and a half commercial about, you know, someone.
The only thing that I actually will say to that is that I have a theory that many people in the world are good, that people are the heroes of their own story and they have their own perspective and stuff. And so when you sit down and watch something like this with a quasi-controversial figure like Taylor Swift, and to see her actually just sort of be vulnerable, defend herself, talk about herself, it very clearly, I could see some of the strings, you know what I mean? I could tell that to an extent it's engineered to make us understand her. But also, once this was said and done, I was like, I think she's a good person. I was like, and I think she's doing the best that she's able to and the best that she's capable of. Because, I mean, think about any of us, even on social media. It's like we're always kind of presenting an image of ourselves anyways. And so I think it's interesting to really see how much of this feels real and how much of this is a commercial. That's part of the fun for me.
Without a doubt. I mean, I think one of the litmus tests on that is also, I mean, you have to trust your instinct a little bit. Are you being fed a line of bullshit? Is this persona behind the scenes you're seeing so different from what you see out front of the cameras as to be believable, or it's not believable? As someone who's on social media a lot, you know, I tell people all the time, especially people close to me, you know, I tend to make a lot of flirty and, you know, aggressive comments through my social media accounts, but that's not really me. That's kind of the character I mm-hmm. play on social media. People who would know both would be like, that's a kind of a character-esque that you play. And I think everyone has to do it, because you have to protect yourself a little bit. One of the things this film does pretty well is giving her the chance to at least explain, whether or not you believe it, at least explain the kind of differences of this is what I am when I'm in a car after a show versus what you saw on stage where I'm wearing, you know, thigh highs and a crop top and nothing else kind of thing. Let's talk about the director for a second, because this was directed by Lana Wilson, who I did not know. Were you aware of her? Did you know who she was?
No, the name sounds familiar, but...
Her most famous doc was her first, and she's known for doc work, and she won an Emmy for a documentary back in 2013, I think it was called After Tiller, which was a documentary about the assassination of a doctor who would perform late third trimester abortions. Mm-hmm. And it was like what the ramifications were in this town when he was the only doctor who would perform these procedures following his assassination and everything that gets wrapped up into that hot button topic. What a journey from there to 7 years later doing the Taylor Swift documentary. I think it works. I mean, I think she brought a really good kind of light touch to the idea.
That's a very light touch, because it didn't feel like I was being pushed around through it. It felt like it was unfolding in a very natural way.
I think you run into a lot of times with any kind of documentary, but something like this where it's going to be the focus is one person. I think you get the feeling that the camera's been set up and there have been several off-screen questions that you didn't hear. Mm-hmm. And the subject of the shot is responding to those. Here, it felt a lot of times like the camera was turned on and whatever she caught and then edited it together, which mm-hmm. I think is a more authentic capture. I like how they cover her span. You know, they don't really give us years, which I found a little bit frustrating, but everything is basically done on her age. You know, a lot of the Chiron screens were age 22, age 24, age 27, 30, you know, whatever mm-hmm. it was, which is an interesting way to document your life, not by years, because I think of years. I don't really think about what age I was when something happened. I don't know. Did you pick up on that at all? Or
yeah,
I don't know.
And I do. Frankly, I mean, Adele has been releasing albums by her age. So I think it's interesting. It had a point. And especially someone like Taylor Swift, who I wouldn't call her juvenile. But there certainly is, because that's actually what I liked the most about Red 1989 and Lover was the maturity that was present. And that was actually my biggest kind of criticism with Lover, was I wanted her to be a little bit further than she was.
Well, especially in reaction to Reputation, I thought it had a lot of playfulness. I thought it had a lot of, not a girl, not even a young woman, you know, someone who is about to approach their, I thought it had the sensibility of someone in their 30s and what that looks like playful wise. I thought a lot of the songs were wistful, kind of hopeful, you know, a little bit like coming out of like a dark tunnel feel to it. I think a lot of that was my take on it. Listening to it, I felt very emerging from something versus going mm-hmm. into something. Me! Exclamation point was my favorite song of last year.
And really?
Oh my god! Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I probably still tweet about it at least once a month in some way or not.
That's my least favorite song on the album.
All right, we're ending this now. It's been nice talking to you.
Here's the thing.
No, yeah, I love Brendan Urie. I'm a big Panic at the Disco fan. Mm-hmm. So I think that was it. I just like the vibe of the song. I like the playfulness of it. I like everything about the song. I like the construction. I like the earwormy hook of it. I like the message of it. The lyrics really make me laugh and really resonate with me in a personal way. I think that's why I like
the video a little bit. Stunning too.
Between the video for this and the video for, you know, You Need to Calm the Fuck Down, she was very into her pastels for sure, but mm-hmm. very creative, almost like a very classic 90s video. I don't watch a lot of music videos anymore, but it had a very retro vibe in how large and
You Need to Calm Down was very Aqua. And it's
yes
yeah, there's a band that could come back
in this Barbie world for sure. Mm-hmm. You know, so I liked Lover because I thought it was a really good palate cleanser coming out of Reputation, which again I just found a little too dark and self-loathing and I'm broken, you
well
know?
And the song Lover for me was in my top, I can't remember what number I had it at, but it was in my top 10 songs, and that's a little bit more what I like, what I was looking for her, because that does feel like a song. There were several we actually did a full album of, or a full episode of our show about this album.
Oh, nice.
And there's a handful of times where her actual life experience Hits comes out, where I'm like, okay, she wrote that lyric because she's actually been through it in a way that when she, in her first couple albums, there was a lot of imagining what adult life would be like.
Yes, and for sure.
Because there was a handful of times, like, she references drinking several times in Lover in a way that's not like, I'm so old, I drink alcohol. It's more like, we've all been there. And I appreciated it. And that's actually something I appreciated with the documentary. I was shocked to see that it was rated TVMA. I was like, that's shocking to me. And then watching it, she only swears like maybe 3 or 4 times in the documentary. I would say it's fine for young fans of hers.
Yes, for other reasons, I would recommend it. Yeah, but nothing about the language. I mean, I'm also a little desensitized to language, but yeah, I agree with you. Nothing in it. I didn't even pick up that it was rated. I would have guessed TV-14. I didn't even pick up that it was MA. Yeah, nothing in it set me off that, like, oh, you should not watch this, you know, if you are a young person. No,
and also we're at a point now where twofold, where how many young fans does she have and how young are they at this point? I mean, she's 30 years old. Second of all, I've never been a fan of that is this grown artist's responsibility to take care of young people who might like them. I mean, I think it's a nice thing to have in mind, but I appreciated the handful of F-bombs we got because it made me feel more like a 29-year-old person.
Right. That's how someone her age should speak. From her kind of casual conversations with, you know, Joel Little, the producer, the burrito talk, and to talking to her about with her mom about the various issues, to, you know, talking about with her friend Abigail about the babies like a Tamagotchi. That all was like very someone in their 20s who is contemplating, you know, the next phase of their life and marriage and, you know, the occasional F-bomb and cursing. Like, I felt like she was very much in her own skin at that time. And I agree with you because I think a lot of her earlier music was imagining, just like you said. Here, I think her whole personality is very much she's living in her own skin in this own time kind of thing. Let's talk about the overall concept of the album. Here's where a little bit of the manipulation comes in, or at least the artistic game plan on the director's part. So the doc opens with the idea that her entire moral code, she says she refers to as her moral code as a kid and even now as an adult, is that she wants to be good. She wants to be seen as a good person, slash, and this is unspoken, but she does kind of hint at it largely several times. She wants to be liked.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, she talks openly about how so much of her career has been spent seeking praise, that the pat on the head is what has motivated her, which is funny because when you look at it, I mean, you have to imagine a lot of the things she went through where she was kind of forced into exile for a year was in complete backlash to people no longer liking her. What was your take on her whole pathos?
I was not surprised that we get that from these types a lot. It is one of the burdens of being creative, of being artistic.
Were you surprised that she was being so honest about it, though? I think that's what I liked about it, was that she was aware of it.
Yeah, it made me like her more. There's a very, very short story about a personal friend who, a friend of mine was dating him, and I couldn't stand him. I thought he was so annoying, and I thought he tried too hard and all this stuff, and I was having one conversation with him at one point, and something clicked in me where I was like, oh, he wants people to like him. And just that understanding, I was like, that's why you're trying so hard, is you can tell I don't like you. Just that, like, that understanding completely flipped the entire situation on its head, and I love him now. And it's a similar thing with Taylor Swift, where just, like you said, even just the fact that she understood it and admitted it, it made me kind of take down a layer of my guard, you know, my suspicion. Mm-hmm. Like, because there's been a lot of claims that she's falsely humble lobbied at her. Part of me is like, so how should she act? Like, specifically, because you'll be mad if she walks in here like she runs this place, you know, which, I mean, she does, but...
I mean, honestly, there's a quote in there. I think it's Barbara Walters says, you know, Taylor Swift is the music industry. Now, granted, that was after the gargantuan hit that 1989 was, when Lover dropped, now her 7th studio album. She sold more albums in its first week than the other 199 albums in the Billboard 200 combined. So 7 albums fucking in, and she's still racking up those numbers. We still live in her world, and, you know, she does run it.
Because I had an issue with the song The Man. I didn't like it when it came out, and Kristen did, and we were discussing it. And I said the issue for me was that I thought, what are you talking about? You are the man. You completely, when you were to list people in the music industry, she's maybe second to Beyonce, like we were mentioning earlier. It's like she's right in the top echelon. It was one of the things that I was thinking of that song from a very literal Taylor Swift place, and Kristen was listening to it as a woman in the world, and I was like,
yes.
okay, I think I'm there.
I'm glad that you brought that up, because I think this film could be understood in actually one really easy way. We get to see Taylor dealing with different aspects of her life. And these are the categories I came up with. Let me know what you think. So we're dealing with Taylor's and her self-image, Taylor and her career goals, Taylor and her public drama, Taylor, family and friends, and then the evolution of Taylor at the end, politics and activism, and all of her music, the way it's shown in this film, all relates to one of those aspects and making very clear connections to what is going on when that song comes around. Like, so she gets through the whole thing with Mueller and the sexual harassment trial, then comes out with the idea for The Man. And there's an interesting thing. If you listen to the album on Spotify, they've got like a behind the lyrics kind of thing. And she's talking about the inspiration for the film. And I like how she talked about it was she had the idea for a while. And it wasn't until this happened. She wanted to tell a story of what if I lived my life exactly like I did it, but I was a guy? What would people say about me then?
Less, I think.
Without a doubt. You know, if she had a bro squad, no one would give a shit. If she got into a feud with Kanye West and was a man, no one would care. So
I venture to say he wouldn't have picked the fight in the first place. And that's such a tricky, he's at a completely different conversation. I was watching that live when it happened. The part that killed me was I was like, he's right. Single Ladies is infinitely a better and more memorable video. But who do you think you are to take this, to take control of? And also just how short-sighted it was to play into this dynamic of like the mean, angry black man coming up there. The whole thing was a mess, and how it has gone on for as long as it has.
Not until recently did I dive into everything that happened over the next decade after that. But he was always in the wrong on that to me. Like, there was never an aspect of that where what he did was defensible or anything that happened afterwards. So I was always kind of Team Taylor on that. I think she handled that literally as well as could be. Even in the aftermath, you know, they show the interview, the live interview after the VMAs. And she's like, it's Kanye West. Like, what do you want me to say? I don't really know him.
That
but I'm
was
not gonna
so heartbreaking because she was just like, she was terrified. She was like, I don't want to start something. She was like, yeah! I just want you to stop talking to me. Like,
Right. And then after Kim releases it in 2016, the recording that does or does not answer the question of did she know he was going to call her a bitch and want to fuck her, you know, her response is, I don't want to be part of the story that you guys have made me a part of since 2009. This is 2006, literally 7 years later, and she's still having to deal with this. You know, how much do you think Taylor Swift probably listened to Kanye West music in at any point of her life?
To a certain part, one of the biggest mistakes she made was by trying to fix it, by trying to be friends with him. I think she should have just been polite and cordial and gone about her business. You know what I mean? But it's the kind of thing you only learn.
The way we're raised to behave versus the way we need to behave when we are in the public eye. Because everyone is suspect of everything you do, especially when you come off as being trying to be magnanimous or trying to be the larger person. When you're dealing with a piece of shit, you're almost always going to be made to look like the bad guy. There was a great article about the feud, and it goes through every time he would apologize in private. She would come out in like, yeah, we're cool, we're friends, I respect you, like, maybe we're going to collaborate together. And then he'd be like, yeah, I'm going to fuck that bitch, you know, I made her famous. And she's like, I don't know what's happening, you know. And like, it was just always this kind of like very Lucy and the football with Charlie Brown. Kim and Kanye are holding the football and she keeps trying to, you know, kick it and, you know, falling on her ass. Very sympathetic to it, which maybe I was supposed to feel sympathetic to it. It was interesting to see how much it affected her. That was a surprise for me, was this seems to be a big aspect of reputation and having to go away, and the Taylor Swift is over party. It really seems to have affected her, this one specific incident that went on for, you know, 7 years.
I saw a tweet once, and I of course don't remember who said it, but it was really interesting, because the gist of it was, when I saw that happen, I thought, huh, weird, and not this single event is going to cripple both of these artistic minds and dominate a decade of their, like... But it was a similar thing where it's like, and especially for her, especially being that age and having that happen, because I would imagine to an extent you would kind of feel like the other shoe's going to drop at any time. I mean, to be 19 and have that happen, I can see how that would do deep rooted stuff and stuff you don't realize is there until even a couple years later. It's like, I'm still dealing with trauma from that. Like,
when it right after I watched it the day after it came out, this released on January 31st in theaters, select theaters, and on Netflix. Part of Netflix's whole, we have to put it in a theater so we can enter it, you know, in for film awards. Mm-hmm. But I watched it the day after, and when I was, I wasn't live tweeting it while I was watching it, but the whole thing about the hashtag Taylor Swift is over party, the quote that she gives there was about the saddest thing I had ever heard. For me, is probably the defining moment of why I feel empathetic towards her, even more so than I think I probably already did, but also I think I really appreciate what her life is like a bit. She says, hashtag Taylor Swift party is over, Taylor Swift is over party, that's what it was, mm-hmm. was trending worldwide on Twitter, number one. Do you know how many people have to be tweeting that they hate you in order for that to happen? That's not an issue for me. No one is saying Michael Caputo is over party. You know, that's not a trending thing on Twitter. I don't have to deal with millions of people, literally, whether they believe it or not, or just because they're trying to be trendy, saying that. Think about that. Think about what that must feel like, then to also realize it. You know, I think there are probably a lot of celebrities that are so vapid and so drugged or just clueless about what's going on in their lives, they don't realize it. She realizes it and years later is still talking about it.
Yeah, it's also the kind of thing that has always drove me nuts about these types of celebrities, these types of, and particularly women. I feel like it happens to women more than it does men, but it's like when people hate them or are quote unquote over them, I'm like, do you have a problem with the person or do you have a problem with the media? Because it's like, I think you're tired of the media's coverage of this person. And, right. You know, there was one of the Ellen DeGeneres documentaries where she talked about how everybody kept saying that they were so tired of her shoving the I'm gay down their throat. And Ellen was like, I did it twice. She was like, I did an Oprah interview and I did Time Magazine. I said it twice. And it dominated the entire cultural conversation. And I was like,
right.
That's just wild to me that, and I guess, you know, to an extent, I get it. I don't know how realistic it is for people to be that aware of everything going on. I mean, media is largely subliminal to us, but it really, it does drive me nuts when people take it out on the celebrity as if they've never, like, as if I've never said anything stupid. You know what I mean? Right. It's like as if I've never had a bad take that I didn't think about while I was saying it and, you know, to be used against me for years.
So I'm a big Disney head. Like Disney World, Disneyland head. And I'm in several Facebook groups for Disney on Facebook. The Kardashians were in Disney recently. And so someone posted a picture of them. They were online for a ride. It was like Chris and Kim and one of the other ones. I don't even know. But it was, you could always tell Kris Jenner. So someone posted it and be like, ah, oh, the Kardashians are in the park. And like, you know, there's 1,000, because everyone's got a comment like, ah, oh, blah, blah, blah. One person just wrote, God, I hate them. And it made me snap in like a really unhealthy way. I didn't write anything. It was one of those where I wrote several things and I deleted it all.
Uh-huh.
But how could you say you hate them with such, that was it. There was no context. There was no, she killed my cat. There was no, she slept with my man. There was no, she got a part in a movie.
These people are on vacation in Disney World, waiting in line, mind you. You know, right. Like not even skipping to the front.
Right, and this person wasn't even the person who took the picture. This was just a commenter in a fucking Disney pose, in a Disney group where it's supposed to be the happiest Facebook page on the earth. And she said, I hate them. The fuck? Like, I what is wrong with people? And that is kind of my feeling. All of that, I think, was brought up again when I watched this, because that was pretty recently. That was like very like put just after New Year's. I saw that and like, so yeah, so I think I was a little triggered by like what she was on her behalf. I think I was a little bit triggered by the idea that people have such opinions. You don't fucking know her. You don't know these people. You don't know celebrities. I don't know, for to have such definitive opinions on people is kind of shocking, because no one would want that kind of spotlight turned on them. What if I said to this lady in this Facebook group, I hate you?
Mm-hmm.
She would be really mad. She'd be, why? You know, but for the same reason. I don't know you, but apparently we could just make judgments about people. So it really bothered me. So that really resonated for me in this, because that was, I think, one big aspect of her personal journey, I think, that she's gone through, especially the last few years. I think that's kind of the other side of the maturity canal we were talking about before. But the other part is, you know, talking about weight gain and the way, like, her body image has been tracked.
That's a good transition, because again, or for me at least, I saw those headlines before watching the documentary, and it was all like, Taylor Swift opens up about eating disorder and blah, 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 blah. And so I was expecting a real bombshell. The way it was handled in the documentary, while a problem that she went through and is current, and I suppose it will always be with her, it felt a lot more down to earth, maybe. It felt more in context. There was just something about it where she was like, so I would do this thing, it was bad for me, I just was like, man, I really wish that I didn't see all those headlines, because it put a certain connotation in my mind.
You're 100% right. I mean, to the point that, you know, Nikki Glaser, who was one of the talking heads, this was the thing where people were talking about, like not regular people, but like talking heads on TV were talking about Taylor and being annoying, and Taylor and her weight. And Nikki Glaser, actually, after this movie came out, went on and like apologized to her for the comment from several years ago about, you know, chastising her for being too skinny. You should have thought of that 3 years ago, before you, again, don't know this person, but you have made some kind of discussion about it.
When someone is as big as she is, there, it's like us mere mortals, you know, can't reach her godlike status. So we have a tendency to, because Nikki Glaser, as I recall, didn't even remember making the comment. She was like, I don't think that, I must underestimate. So even good people's ability to go for low hanging fruit. I mean, sometimes you just grab what's there.
This is as much turning the lens on how we treat people as it is Taylor Swift's story, I think. I mean, that was kind of my takeaway, was trying to be a little more conscious of what I say, especially about what I say about other people. That was a legitimate takeaway from this, was because of that she could say something that affected, that Taylor Swift would remember it, you know, or it would be part of her psyche.
Because they didn't just pull that out of the archive, that somebody remembered that, you know?
Taylor just breaks your heart in this with some of her quotes. She goes, you know, I don't think you know you're doing it if you're doing it gradually, talking about falling into the eating disorder escape. That's so real. That is not someone paying her to talk about an eating disorder. That is like a legitimate, real,
and she also wasn't doing it for attention, because I think that's the negative thing, is people think, oh god, we get that way a lot recently with mental health conversations, where it's like we have a knee-jerk reaction sometimes, where we're like, well, do you actually have problems, or are you looking for attention? The way it was handled in the documentary, it doesn't look like she was trying to get attention. Like, it doesn't look like she was trying to make some after-school special statement. It was a very open, very honest, and very casual conversation she was having.
She gave really honest examples about it, where she would say, you know, of course I eat enough, but I'm exercising. That's why I'm a 00 and versus size 6. But then she's like, but then I had to realize that, no, I was exercising a lot. That's true. You know, I put on an athletic performance, but I was not eating enough. This shines for me because of her self-realization. I think that is the big takeaway here that I wasn't expecting. I was surprised at how self-realized she comes off in this. I think that's hard to fake. I took this sincere.
Yeah, another moment that really got me, because, you know, I'm sure you've noticed I'm doing a lot of comparison to Britney, because that was my thing. And Britney had several documentaries like this, too.
And a very public breakdown, and a very public, you know, retreat from the world, because she broke down in front of all of us.
She, when Taylor said that, you know, she was like, my life is planned 2 years in advance. Like, that is a lot to process in a time like the 20s, where you're going through as much growth and change as you are. Towards the end of the documentary, when she said that, saying about how people get frozen in the age where they become famous, and it's like, the fact that she knows that she's making an attempt to not fall or stay in that place. I think self-awareness is the key to so many people's problems. It's like, if you can even just get like 40% self-awareness, I think you're doing better than most. And it was refreshing. I loved watching her with, one of them was Jackie Antonoff, and I don't know who the other guy was. I'm assuming he was one of her producers or writers.
Joel Little, who I want to talk about a little bit. He was the one on The Lover that you saw mostly besides Jack. He was the only other one we really saw besides Jack.
It was just so fascinating, and it actually felt like a treat to me to get to watch someone just create. It was like she was pulling phrases out of the air. It's like it exists. Well, it's like the muse. That was the whole Greek philosophy with the muse, is that she gives it to you and it's up to you to assemble it and present it in a tangible way. That's tricky, because I think a lot of people who have talent like that can have a tendency to discredit themselves and to not value what they do, if it comes naturally. She seems to have a very healthy relationship, and she seems to know her worth, which is nice. You know,
well, she said again, but she says explicitly, "I'm very much aware that if it wasn't for me writing my songs, I wouldn't have a career. The career I have is very much informed by me writing these songs." Yeah, so yeah, she's aware of it. I mean, we get to watch her lay down, and then Joel jumps on with the drum machine. She puts down into her Apple memo notes the first verse and part of the chorus of "Me." Like, we saw that on camera. Mm-hmm. The camera caught that, and that she had been humming it. I mean, there's a lot of, especially "Me" in particular, of that, the way that song is getting developed throughout this. That was kind of a recurring theme. Yeah, I mean, she just kind of went out there, and she had a producer who was able to creatively support her, and he puts in a drum track that sounds very much like the militaristic snare drum part that becomes part of the "Me" song. They were creating art right there with her fucking Apple phone. Like, mm-hmm. It was pretty impressive.
And that's something that, like, and I do think that the general public has done a decent job with this, but even still, that's something that annoys me so much about this current slate of pop stars, because, you know, for a while with the Britneys, there was a complaint that they weren't, like they were fake. They were engineered. She's not singing live. She's not writing her own music. She's not. And for a long time, Britney had the dancing. You know, I'll argue Britney's creativity till we're blue in the face, but it's something I credit American Idol with when American Idol became so big, that we do have a crop of pop stars now who are singing live, who are writing their own music, who are playing their own instruments. It's like we have so much evidence to the fact that she is a actual musician. If I were to list, songwriter would come first for me. And like you kind of mentioned a second ago, it's like she could quit being a pop star tomorrow and still live the rest of her life writing music.
I mean, I didn't realize it. When I went looking into her a little bit, she's won Grammys for songs she's written and not performed. She wrote a song for, I want to say it was Little Big Town or Sugarland. It was one of those country groups. She wrote a song for them that they performed, put on their album, and she won like a Song of the Year award for it, because the Song of the Year is the songwriting award. Again, not performing on it, not even a feature with Taylor Swift.
Well, at the Rihanna and Calvin Harris song, "This Is What You Came For," she wrote it. She has such a prose. She has such a specific style that when we were, and I'm going to bring this up, when we were watching Cats, there's a song halfway through the movie that makes sense. And I just went, "This is the Taylor Swift song." Kristen was like, "How can you tell?" I was like, "Because it sounds like her." I was like, not her voice, the content of the song. And when, like I said, it's the one time that the movie actually has a narrative where you're like, "Oh, okay, I understand what's happening in this scene."
I actually liked Cats.
I loved it so much.
you could also tell that song because it's Victoria, the new cat, sing it also. But yeah, no, I totally agree with you. It had a very, I was looking forward to it because I saw some of the behind the scenes with her writing with Andrew Lloyd Webber, who I'm a big fan of. So I was waiting for it, and then I was not disappointed when I heard it in the movie.
I explicitly didn't listen to it when it came out. I wanted to see it in the movie because there's a handful of, Sia's another one where it's like, I can pick out a Sia song on the song structure alone, like even when someone else is singing it. Like when we were seeing Pitch Perfect 2 and Hailee Steinfeld started singing that Flashlight song, I was like, "See, I wrote this." And we stayed through the credits just to make sure, and I was right, you know? So
before we get into just the final yays or nays, there's a couple things I want to talk about some of the supporting cast in here. We have to talk about the politics part of it, because that actually takes up a large part of the back end of the film. What was your take on her very much at 22 having what I think is the right policy for an artist or any kind of celebrity, actor, or singer? You don't want to hear my views on politics. You want to hear me sing songs. She gets the fist bump with Letterman because of what she's been through. She feels a need to speak out and get involved in the 2018 midterm elections. Did that coverage in the doc work for you? Did it feel manipulative? Because I could see where some people be very turned off by that aspect of the film. Or did that seem like a good evolution to where she is for you?
It was my favorite part of the entire documentary.
Why? But that's interesting. Why?
It was very real. And it's the kind of thing where it's like, I've been on both sides of this conversation, and I don't know how actually into politics we're planning on getting here, but
lightly. No, but no one wants to hear our views on politics either. They want to hear us talk about Taylor Swift.
Well, the rule of thumb that Chris and I have is we talk about it if it's part of the subject matter. Sure. And we use a lot of I believe or I feel. And I was raised in a moderately conservative household, and I have since ventured into a more moderately liberal place in my life. I could very much understand her entire arc, starting as a young country darling from Pennsylvania, moving to Tennessee, understandably having a large conservative base. I mean, she's the American dream. She's tall, she's thin, she's blonde. You know, it's like she couldn't be more...
Can we talk about how fucking tall she is? I knew she was tall. She's giant. She's 5'10", 5'11", depending on what website you go to. But when she's in Tokyo, she looked like fucking like blonde Mothra. She's fucking huge.
And also,
she's so huge. And she doesn't know what to do with her body. She's so gangly. And I love that about her. She's so awkward.
Well, and someone like, who mad is, props to her doing those meets and greets, because that's got to be exhausting. Trying to emotionally give yourself to a fan in like minute spurts.
And bent over the entire time. She was 18 inches taller than anyone in that entire scene of the movie. But like, you see her walking back and forth from the stage a little bit a couple times. And granted, she wears heels, which makes her even taller. But there's a gangliness about her because she is so thin, where it almost seems like she doesn't know what to do with her right. But I found it very endearing because it was like, she doesn't carry herself like she's a runway model. She's just this kind of, you know, young woman who doesn't know what to do with her height kind of thing sometimes. I found it very endearing, but she is so fucking tall. But anyway, continue. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, actually one of my favorite, there's a picture from the Victoria's Secret Fashion Show a few years ago, and it's her and Ed Sheeran and the models, because her and Ed Sheeran were the musical guests, and he's looking around and he's hysterically laughing, and somebody finally asked him why, and he said it was this surreal moment where they were on stage and he looked around and he said he felt like Frodo in the Land of the Elves. And he just couldn't get past it. But yeah, so
that's really funny.
In that regard, I completely understand where she's coming from with I'm just not gonna get involved. And that was my MO for so long. This is, you know, where I get very lightly political. It's like, in my opinion, we're in a slightly different scenario. We're in a slightly different place right here and right now, where I think a lot of people feel a duty to speak up. I don't feel like we're in a business as usual place. I remember in like 2015, maybe, I think she kind of ventured into not a feud, but there was a thing going back and forth with Nicki Minaj and somebody else, and they were talking about representation, and Nicki was like, and Taylor, you should be speaking about this. And there was a part of me that I thought, could you imagine? Like, could you imagine if Taylor Swift started talking about, like, African-American issues and visibility? And I was like, she would be slaughtered. Like, people would be like, who do you think you are speaking on behalf of? So I was very in the don't say anything camp. And I do also think at the end of the day that artists tell their truth. It's like, that is sort of, how do you separate? I mean, when you look at how raw she is and how she airs so much of her personal emotional feelings and stuff, it's like, how can some political stuff not seep out? And to that, it's like, I frankly think it's kind of disgusting that like identities, that ethnicities and gender identities and all that can be considered politics. It's like, for me, that's something completely different. But it's like, politics is like taxes and stuff, you know what I mean? But
yeah,
I actually did like You Need to Calm Down. She got a lot of pushback from some people being like, you know, within the LGBT community, being like, who do you think you are? You're, you know, a straight cis white woman speaking on our behalf. I'll admit, the first time I heard that song, I rolled my eyes. I was like, oh god, Taylor. But in the grand scheme of things, she did it the right way. That's another thing that really bugs me, is when people do things the right way. She got as many co-signatures and proper co-signatures on that thing. She talked to the right people. She did everything the right way. And I believe her. I believe that she meant it. And I believe that she actually was attempting to do something good. And on top of that, have fun with it. So at the end of the day, I love it, actually.
I think I probably would have had a different view about it had I not seen this. But watching her fight with her father, you know, granted, I mean, her mother comes off much more involved in her life than her father does. But knowing how thankful she is to her parents, I mean, for her father leaving his New York job to move to Tennessee and everything he's done, to watch her get into an argument with him about becoming involved in politics, to the toll about, you know, sending out their first Instagram about it, to the activism that seems to be woken up. You know, she has that scene with Todrick Hall, and then they win the VMA, and then she talks, you know, about the petition for equal rights.
There was a moment where she was talking to the Queer Eye guys, and she was talking to Jonathan, and it was so fascinating because she was listening to him. And it was very interesting to see the power dynamic shift a little bit, and to see how seriously that she was taking it, that you could tell she was that she was listening to him. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's like, I wouldn't say she's woke, but I think she's awakened. I would hope that she would agree with that. That was the message we were supposed to take away from there, was there's a fire in her belly now that not only gave us an awesome banger in Only the Young, which you can listen on Spotify. I think this is the next phase for her, seems to be using this power she has amassed for what she sees as good.
Fascinating. That scene was my favorite scene in the entire documentary, because you were watching, it was suddenly like a scene from The Little Mermaid playing out in front of us. And I was like, she's one of the most powerful people in the world right now, and she still is, to an extent, answering to her father, to see the moment where she kind of is like, I'm going to do this, whether you like it or not.
He's giving her hard pushback, not just for the cost to her career, but the genuine, I always took it as like a father, not granted I don't have a daughter, I have a son, but as a father who, he seemed very concerned about what this would do to her for the attacks that he suspected would come her way. But there was also the very business aspect of it too, you know, celebrity. It's not coincidental that they bring up the Dixie Chicks and talk about them at length from when she was younger, and that Dixie Chicks are also featured on the latest album. I think all of that is not a coincidence that it was in here, but they remained the poster child for talking about politics in public.
Those types of political statements, the subtle ones, I think are some of the best. Like when Lover came out and the Dixie Chicks were on it, I was like, that's a statement. I was like, that's not happenstance. She's made a political statement with that, but it's sneaky. And I think those are the more effective ways of doing it.
But it all makes sense, though, when you see it in the timeline. She's writing Lover in 2018. She gets wakened for politics in the midterm election with Blackburn in the Senate race in Tennessee in 2018. The Dixie Chicks wind up on her album in 2018. Like, it's all very organic. None of it felt forced to me. It all felt like this is just where she is now, and she's being aware of what she is, to the point that she's going to fight with her father, and luckily had her mother's support for it, you know? Because
at the end of the day, that's what we all are, is members of families. Was very interesting. It was very fascinating, and I don't think she's overdone it. I think she was doing it the right way, and I do. I think her heart is in the right place. I'm at a place now where it's something I've said about Lady Gaga a lot, where it's like, I believe 85-90% of what comes out of her mouth. Like, when she says things, I believe her. And Taylor Swift, I was further down on that. I was in more of a 50-50 place. But after watching this, I'm like, oh, no, I think I do. I think I do believe you when you're saying these things, when you're talking, when you're expressing yourself. And I did enjoy it. And as a matter of fact, I'm going to recommend it to a handful of my friends who don't particularly like her all that much. And I'm going to be like, you should go ahead and watch this just to see what you think.
Changes your mind about her. One thing I wanted to talk about was, I think she came off incredibly lonely in this, even with her boyfriend. She seems like someone who had made a name with her squad and stuff, which was very noticeably absent in this film. And I learned, I guess she gave an article in like early 2019 about how the squad's basically dissolved, that in hindsight, she's learned that a lot of those people are just kind of hangers on, and some of them have remained friends. But for the most part, the age of the squad is over, which probably is more a reflection of her approaching 30 than anything else. But she comes off as extremely lonely, as someone who spends a lot of time, if she's not working, like with very limited people around her. But I want to talk about those people, because there wasn't a lot of them, and I feel like they all had kind of a prominent place, and I want to ask your opinions on them. What do you think of the relationships with her and her mother, and her and Abigail Anderson Lucier, who is the quote-unquote childhood friend we see? That's the conversation with the Tamagotchi baby conversation. Was that there for us to see, like, the sensitive side of Taylor, or was this like a real moment, the interactions with her mom, the interactions with
Adam? Oh, I believe everything about the interactions with her mom. I found that very relatable. I'm very close with my mother, and it looked and felt similar.
I was very compelled by her talking about her mother's cancer diagnosis and having, again, more self-realization about who she is and where she is, talking about how it's hard to get up in arms about the, you know, celebrity struggle when your mom has cancer. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea of getting a little perspective in life is kind of necessary sometimes. Again, I think there are a lot of people that would miss that point. Celebrity mm-hmm. or not, I think there are a lot of people that would miss that point. So I also was affected by that.
Yeah, I did. I really liked it. And also, as you mentioned, the kind of the family argument. I threw down that Little Mermaid reference on purpose. There's a fairy tale-esque quality to her entire existence. It's all over her music. I did enjoy getting to see a glimpse of it. It felt real. I didn't have much to say about Abigail. I do think that that's crucial for people in industries to have friends right. who are not in the industry. Number one, help you stay grounded. Number two, I like celebrity memoirs. I've read Judy Greer's book, and she's talked about all the people that she's worked with and how you form. She said it's kind of like living in summer camp because you form these really close, really intense bonds with people for 3 months at a time. And then sometimes you literally never see them again. So that's why a lot of people in the industry tend to have a team, like a stylist and a makeup artist and stuff, because it's like that becomes your actual family unit. I would imagine, I think she's probably still friends with some of those people in the squad, because I know for a fact that she's the actress James King, or I guess her name's Jamie. Her modeling name was James King, and that's what I always call her. I think she's the godmother to James' baby.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
So
I didn't know that.
I would imagine they're still friendly, relatively close. But yeah, I did get that feeling, the loneliness, especially in her hideous house.
Well, she's got the huge house. But like the Grammy conversation, you brought it up at the very beginning of this conversation. She talks about later when she's on top of the world after she wins, you know, best album and for the 1989. And, you know, she's talking to herself about getting it all and then realizing she had no one to share it with. That I very much appreciate that. But when she gets that call from her agent or manager telling her she got no nominations, and holy shit, what an awkward phone call that is to make. But she's just alone. She's got her cat, but she's got no one else in that big fucking house to commiserate with, you know?
The self-awareness to be actually genuinely hurt and upset, but to know that it's quote-unquote silly or frivolous, that right. it's like it doesn't mean anything. She already has Grammys. And so you can really see her grappling with that back and forth about like, man, this hurt my feelings. And
right.
it shouldn't.
But isn't it the moment where you want someone on the couch with you holding, mm-hmm. listening in on the other end of the phone and then like putting your head on their shoulder when you get such bad news? Like that's when you want someone there. Even if it's a friend, you want someone there to share that moment with you, good or bad. I very much felt loneliness for her in that moment. I was a little put off by like the Abigail conversation because, again, I like Taylor Swift. I'm a fan of her music, but I have not spent my life delving into her personal life, but I didn't realize that's the Abigail that's name checked in 15, in the song 15 from Fearless, from her second album. And one of the verses starts with, you know, you sit down, you meet a redhead girl named Abigail, and you know, you kind of like put off the mean girls. That's the Abigail in the film that is in that song. They mm-hmm. really have been friends like since she was 15. So it wasn't just like a hang around. That is like a legitimate, has remained a best friend, not in the business.
And her. I think someone like her needs three of those.
At least.
Think her people need, the people she has around her. There was a weird quote from Perez Hilton in this, and I was like, is it 2008? Why are you reading Perez Hilton? Where are you going to get your information?
I have a complicated relationship with Perez Hilton, most of it stemming from the fact that it's 2020 and not 2008.
Yeah. So I was kind of like, you need to update some of your resources.
That's really funny.
And I can
see how you
could get caught and like stuck in certain routines.
My last thing on the loneliness thing, and I think this helps him in the film, and he turns out to be my favorite person in the entire film, but I think it's interesting the relationship they seem to have. So Joel Little, who is the main producer we see, you end up seeing the other one, Antonoff. Later on, but most of the interaction she has with people besides her mother, the most common interaction she has in just normal talking is with Joel Little during the songwriting sessions for Lover. He seems like the chillest guy who is just someone normal for her to talk to. You know, he's married, he's British, he gets the music, but you know, they also have that great burrito conversation. They have this conversation about how just kind of how she goes about her life, and he talks to her about how manic her life is with scheduling and how she always has 8,000 things she has. Like, he talks about it like in kind of an all way, but he's not talking down to her, nor is he like worshiping her. He's just a guy. He's just a person for her to be a friend with. And again, it was struck me how few people seem. She doesn't have a squad around her. You have this image of like when like rap stars go and record their albums. Mm-hmm. Their posses, their entourages are with them, you know, rolling 10, 15 people deep. There wasn't any of that here. I mean, maybe they were hiding in the other room, but a lot of it seemed just to be her and this guy, Joel, that he had not produced for her. This was the first album he ever produced any tracks for her with. You know, he was Lord's producer. Just really liked him because I liked that he was such a normal friend for her, as well as a collaborator and seemingly a pretty good producer, since mm-hmm. he produced two of the three best tracks, I think, on the album. He was my real MVP of the whole film. I hope other people liked him too. I don't know. I haven't gone to look because I don't want people to be like, that guy is fucking weird. But like, I really liked him. It really actually made me like the whole movie more. I liked watching that burrito. Again, I keep talking about, I think it's like the fifth time I brought up the burrito conversation, but that was such a real moment like I would have with a friend. You know, and then she's talking about how she adds crunchies now that she's become a burrito head in the last year. She adds like crunchies for like the kick and stuff. I love that whole scene. That was my absolute favorite scene in the entire goddamn film.
You would like 5'2", I think. It's a lot of the Lady Gaga one. It's a lot more of that.
I'm all about that. Yeah.
It's her and Mark Ronson and a lot of him. What is his name now? Blood Pop. And Florence Welch is in it for about 20 minutes. And it's a lot more of that kind of stuff.
Very cool. All right. So we've come to the end here. And now the big question, Will, are you going to love it or are you going to leave it?
Love it. Yeah. For me, it's a solid 4 out of 5, especially if you're even remotely into her or pop music in general. You know, I've mentioned my business partner, Kristen, her husband, Will, he's a bit more of a like a rock heavy metal guy, but he's watched a couple of these documentaries with us. And I don't know if he would watch this one. It gives an authentic and real glimpse into what could very easily be written off as like a superficial world, as a silly and superficial world. These are pop songs. They're engineered to sell and 3 minutes and distract and all of that. And I think these and this one in particular makes a really solid case for the integrity and the talent and the empathy of the people behind this world. Because at the end of the day, everybody is just a person trying to do their best. I think it's a tall order, and I think it's actually worthy of a little bit of respect when someone gives the world so much of themselves for the purpose of creating happiness.
I think that's very well said. I also loved it. I loved it for a couple of reasons. One, I think obviously if you're a Taylor Swift fan, I think this is must watch viewing. I think if you're a music fan or a fan of celebrity, I think it's must watch viewing. But this really spoke to me because my big takeaway was the story of a girl or woman who didn't know who she was supposed to be, had spent a life being like what other people wanted her to be. And in that process, never really figured out until maybe very recently who she is and who she is supposed to be for herself. I think a lot of people struggle with that, especially a lot of teens. And this struck me as the kind of thing, like, I would like my son to have the kind of grounded maturity that she has at 30. I would want him to watch this. I would want any teen who has identity issues, any teen who is struggling to feel like they have to fit in, like they're a loser, like they don't know who they're supposed to be in the world, so spend time being what other people want them to be. This is the kind of person I would like them to listen to talk and watch their journey go mm-hmm. through. So for that, I really loved it.
You know, what's interesting to me is I agree, but I feel like she did know who she was and who she was supposed to be. That first time we see her at 13, that's the same person she is in those writing sessions with, what did you say his name was?
Joel Little.
That feels like the person we see at the very end of the documentary. I think that she did know who she was, and the world kind of got in her way and got in her mind.
That's actually interesting. I think that's probably true. I think she probably did spend the middle part of her late teens and most of her 20s trying to push back and maybe got lost a little bit. I think you're probably mm-hmm. right. So maybe
playing the role of a pop star, yeah.
Right, rediscovering who she is. But I think the message still holds, though, of trying to be true to yourself. Absolutely. Trying to push back against what others say you should be, and trust that you are right. If it takes family, if it takes, you know, close friends, if it takes a producer who eats burritos with you, whatever it is, find that person, hold on to them, and, you know, don't let the world fuck you. Will, thank you so much. I hope everyone goes and listens to So I'm Watching the Show. You guys have several podcasts a week. Where can people find you and your podcast on social media?
Oh my God, I never do this part. Well, my Twitter handle is Willow719, W-I-L-L-O-719. Our show handle is So I'm Watching, one word. And then we have a website, soimwatching.com. Everything links out from there.
Oh, you got that. All right. I was checking on you. I would have gently corrected you had you gotten any of it wrong. I don't want Kristen to yell at you. But yes, definitely check out Will and Kristen. They are very funny. And we're happy to have them over here on the Clubhouse. And
anytime.
Yeah. Thanks so much for coming out and talking with me today about Miss Americana.
Absolutely.
And Will, when you think of Tim McGraw, I hope you think of me. Have a good night. Thanks for listening. Thank you for listening. This has been an original Pod Clubhouse production. Pod Clubhouse is a podcast network dedicated to encouraging collaboration among podcasters and friends to bring a fresh voice and diverse perspective on a wide array of content. Please visit and leave a comment for us at podclubhouse.com. Rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast feeds on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find us at Pod Clubhouse. Our DMs are always open, and we'd love to hear from you.
Pod Clubhouse!